Good morning and welcome to Real People Talk Autism. I'm Tony Langdon and I'll be hosting the show as Beck is unfortunately not able to make it this week. Before we go on with the show, a little bit about the station and then the show. We're on Phoenix FM at www.phoenixfm.org.au where you can hit the Listen Live link on the top right of the page if you out of the Bendigo area. Of course, we're broadcasting in Bendigo on 106.7 on your FM dial. And we have a Facebook page at Phoenix. So just look up Phoenix FM and you should be able to find the Facebook page. Also, the show has its own Facebook page. Look up Real People Talk Autism on Facebook and you can find us there and like us. We have a Twitter feed at Talk Autism Radio Oz. I believe Beck's the expert on the Twitter stuff. And we do have a podcast. This show will be up on podcast probably later on today at realpeopleasd.podomatic.com. This week we continue our recap of past shows, starting off on the subject of education with an interview with Dr. Emma Goodall, followed by a presentation from Temple Grandin. After that, we go into talking law and order with an interview with Stephen from the Office of the Public Advocate. And in between, there'll be quite a bit of music. Hope you enjoy the show.
106.7 Phoenix FM.
I'm an autism awareness angel, making sure my wings protect the different, the stranger than. I'm an autism awareness angel, it's good, cause I'm cool with the unique behavior. I'm an autism awareness angel, will you accept me, cause I accept you. I'm an autism awareness angel, cause the view from the spectrum is a better point of view. The question at hand, are you aware of autism, and that it affects 1 in 110 children? This goes past seeing the movie Rain Man, or Jenny McCarthy, or Temple Grandin. A word when heard can leave a family devastated, exhausted, hopeless, lonely, and isolated. A social disorder, not only kids get it, when you get the diagnosis, the whole family gets it. I'm giving you a place in your mind where you can put the unique behaviors and lose the strange looks. If I reach out to you when this hits home, then maybe you can reach out so they won't feel so alone. Mandated to educate and eliminate the ignorance, for sure find a cure, in the meantime make a difference. Open our eyes, wake up and realize, and don't judge. Show that you care if you're aware and just show love. I'm an autism awareness angel, making sure my wings protect the different, the stranger than. I'm an autism awareness angel, it's good, cause I'm cool. Public is, say, a grocery store, and seen that parent trying to get their kid up off the floor. Or maybe you've seen kids rock, hands flapping, with no headphones on, but like the beat was slapping. Or maybe you offer them a toy from the shelf, but they just want to line up Thomas trains all by themselves. You may say a phrase to them, some say the phrase back, but most of my peeps won't give you eye contact. I'm here to enlighten you on these delightful children, to not be alarmed, they just process different. Accepting them and joining in with them's a good direction toward bonding with them. You give the green light, then there's connection. Autism, it's a challenge, it ain't a curse. If you ignore it, then isolation surely will make it worse. When people don't know nothing, then nothing's what they do. I'm happily autistically aware, cause I got two. Hey yo, I'm an autism awareness angel, making sure my wings protect the different, the stranger than. I'm an autism awareness angel, it's good, cause I'm cool with the unique behavior. I'm an autism awareness angel, will you accept me, cause I accept you. I'm an autism awareness angel, cause the view from the spectrum is a better point of view.
And good morning. I'm Bette Kelly, the host of Real People Talk Autism. And that was Greg Milk with Army of Autism Awareness Angels Anthem. I thought that I'd change things up a bit this morning and pop a little tune in before I started the show. I'm in this studio by myself today. We have Dr. Emma Goodall coming back onto the show. Last week's interview I felt was a little bit rushed because of all the things that went on with getting her on the phone. So she's here in Australia at the moment, so we're going to have a really great chat. I've got some fantastic questions to actually ask her from our listeners, so thank you very much to the people who have emailed through. Now, if you're not familiar who she is a special needs educator as well as a public speaker and an author, and she is on the spectrum herself, and she is wanting to dish out some fantastic advice on how children with autism learn and how we can teach the teachers to teach our children. So a bit of info about the station. You can get onto our website, www.phoenixfm.org.au. Check out previous podcasts from a while back, because we now have a Podomatic realpeopleasd.podomatic.com, I think it is. Anyway, Tony is our podcaster extraordinaire. Our podcast will be a little bit late today because Tony's got lots going on today, but don't worry, it will be up later on this afternoon, early this evening. As I said, our feedback email is feedback@phoenixfm.org.au. And we also have a Facebook page, www.facebook.com/realpeopletalkautism, as well as a Twitter page, which is at ASD Talk Radio. So you can get on there, message me anything you'd like, if you'd like us to play any kind of music, if you would like to hear anything, any topics that you would like us to cover on the show, please message those through to our Facebook page. Either myself, Sarah, or Tony will get them, and we will endeavour to get the best people possible on the show. If you have any recommendations for someone you would like to hear on the show, please send those through to us as well. So I'm going to go off to a little bit of a music break here, and let me see. I might play a track off Meredith's new album, Wild Child. It's called Survive. This is her first release single off Wild Child. And she's a local artist here in Bendigo. She's also an autism mum. She's fantastic. So this is Meredith's Wild Child. Speak to you soon.
Talk about me behind my back. You wanna create the drama based on what you see. Have you ever stopped to notice? You don't actually know me.
Phoenix FM. Well, you only need the light when it's burning low. Only miss the sun when it starts to snow. Only know you love her when you let her go. Only know you've been high when you're feeling low. Only hate the road when you're missing home. Only know you love her when you let her go. And you let her go. Staring at the bottom of your glass, hoping one day you'll make a dream last. But dreams come slow and they go so fast. You see it when you close your eyes. Maybe one day you'll understand why everything you touch surely dies. But you only need the light when it's burning low. Only miss the sun when it starts to snow. Only know you love her when you let her go. Only know you've been high when you're feeling low. Only hate the road when you're missing home. Only know you love her when you let her go. Staring at the ceiling in the dark, same old empty feeling in your heart. Cause love comes slow and it goes so fast. Well, you see her when you fall asleep, but never to touch and never to keep. Cause you loved her too much and you dive too deep. Where you only need the light when it's burning low. Only miss the sun when it starts to snow. Only know you love her when you let her go. Only know you've been high when you're feeling low. Only hate the road when you're missing home. Only know you love her when you let her go. And you let her go. Oh, oh. You let her go. Oh, 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 oh. Will you let her go? Cause you only need the light when it's burning low. Only miss the sun when it starts to snow. Only know you love her when you let her go. It's burning low. Only miss the sun when it starts to snow. Only know you love her when you let her go. Only know you've been high when you're feeling low. Only hate the road when you're missing home. Only know you love her when you let her go. And you let her go.
And I'm back, and that was Let Her Go by the band Passenger, which I think is an absolutely stunning song. It's just truly beautiful. Now, as I said before, we went off to our little sponsor break. I'm very, very pleased to let everybody know that we have not had any problems in getting Emma Goodall on the phone today, which is quite exciting because I would love to just continue this conversation that we started last week with her, and as well as a few other questions that our listeners have. Now, just a bit of a rundown. Dr. Emma Goodall is an autism consultant and special needs teacher and advisor who has Asperger's. Her PhD research factors involved in teaching students on the autistic spectrum and how teachers feel about teaching these students. Realising how different autistic and non-autistic thinking is, Emma is passionate about enabling families and educators to understand these differences and work with autistic spectrum children and adults in a positive way. She's also the author of the fantastically popular Understanding and Facilitating the Achievement of Autistic Potential. Welcome back to the show, Emma. How are you?
and thank you for having me back on.
Oh, no, I'm so happy to have you back on because I really wanted to continue the discussion that we started last week because I think we needed to flesh it out more, but also I really wanted our listeners to be able to pose questions to you because you have this such this great knowledge, and I guess as I wrote on our Facebook page, you know, this is the woman that people need to be asking questions to because you are changing the face of education in New Zealand, and you're now here in Australia and you will be coming over here to live, which is really exciting. It's great for the Australian public. So obviously I have a lot of questions to get to. You're a popular woman, let me tell you that.
Well, let's get on with the questions.
Okay, well, I'll actually start with some questions from Sarah, my co-host. She has actually written some rippers here for you. So what is your personal opinion as an autistic person on social skills training? How did you learn social skills?
I learned social skills mainly through learning etiquette, so learning politeness. You were drilled in very young age, and phrases like I want doesn't get still ring in my head when I hear I want. It's please can I have, please may I have, thank you very much. And I didn't really learn social skills for interacting with people until quite late on in life, but because I was polite, it wasn't an issue so much. And I think one of the difficulties with social skills training programs that we see a lot of now is that they're actually trying to get people on the spectrum to be fully social, like non-autistic people, and that's not comfortable for us. For me, social skills should be about learning those basic etiquette skills so that we're accepted by people in society as polite members of society.
Mm-hmm. So your thoughts on social skills training then? Because there's a lot going on, and sadly there's a lot of people making a lot of money off it as well.
There's a lot of people making a lot of money because you can't actually make us normal, and therefore the social skills training is never ending. So the social skills program that I like is one called Super Skills, and it's from the US, and it was actually designed for autistic children, and it teaches things like looking at people, not making eye contact, but looking at people when you want to talk to them. And it explains about tone of voice and facial expression and what that means to the people that we're communicating with. And I learned a lot actually through teaching this particular program to small groups of kids. And it's really good because you can use it in mainstream classrooms with everybody, because we tend to forget that a lot of neurotypical kids have no social skills either.
Mm. I think that's something that sort of gets lost on a lot of teachers, with that us against them kind of thing, that divide that happens in the classroom when you do have one or more children with special needs in there, that they believe that there's that certain way of teaching them and the certain way of teaching neurotypicals, and this is where things are getting lost, I think. Do you agree?
Yes, I agree completely. And it's very easy to just label the special needs children as having deficits, if you like, whereas the neurotypical children, they might just say, oh, you know, that's just the family that they come from. And so it's okay that they're rude, and yet if an autistic child is something that's perceived as rude, it's not seen as the autism, it's seen as rudeness. It's very interesting.
Mm. So another question she's posed here is, what are your thoughts on ABA?
ABA has been shown to not be useful with all autistic children.
Mm-hmm.
And ABA, when it is just repeat, can be torturous for some children. However, it can also work for some children, and it's really difficult to sort of make a blanket statement on it. I think it depends on the person doing the ABA as much as the fact that it's labelled ABA.
Because as I said, there is this tendency to, you know, you're either an ABA child or an early start child, or you're a social skills child, or, you know, a sensory processing child. And I guess, as I said, it's all about making money. And this is what's so frustrating to me, Emma.
It is really frustrating, because it should be about a profile of an individual child. What are their strengths and what are their challenges? And how do we use their strengths to increase those areas that they need increasing? And this isn't about using only ABA or only social skills or using anything in particular. It's about having a real-life program for those children in their real-life situations, home or preschool or school, that works.
Mm. So now, I actually read recently an article that you were a part of, and it was actually from a while back, about autism being overly diagnosed. And I recently had someone ask me if it was the new ADHD, and it actually really offended me. Do you still believe that autism is overly diagnosed?
I still believe that some people prefer to have an autism diagnosis than, for example, an ADHD diagnosis, or I don't know.
Mm.
And part of it is to do with the fact that you get funding, and part of it is to do with the fact that because there's been a lot of autism advocacy, it is a more socially acceptable diagnosis than, for example, oppositional defiant disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that parents can learn the right answers to give, and it's really difficult because it doesn't do a child any service to make up answers at a screening.
Mm. I heard too that psychologists are also a little bit funny about giving a child an autism diagnosis along with ODD because they're so very similar. Do you agree with that?
Yes. It's also very much dependent on the psychologist. Some psychologists, for example, don't believe that autism is particularly prevalent in females and so won't diagnose. So it's underdiagnosed by some psychologists and overdiagnosed by others.
Yeah, and there's also pathological avoidance disorder, is that right?
I don't know that one. That's not one that I've heard that we haven't used that in New Zealand.
No, I was reading up about it, and I actually follow the page, and a lot of children who have gotten an autism diagnosis in their younger years are now getting this diagnosis in their later years, and it's cancelling out the autism diagnosis where it almost mimics autism to a T. I guess we've got all these disorders running around. It's just crazy. I think that people are very quick to label. Do you agree with that, or do you think that, you know, that it's very broad?
I think that part of the difficulty is, and this has intrigued me coming over to Australia, is that there is no set diagnostic tools used in Australia. I don't know about the rest of Australia, but in South Australia they certainly don't have set diagnostic tools. In New Zealand you have to use particular screening tools, and then you have to use particular diagnostic tools. Mainly the ADOS and the ADIR, which have been normed and validated repeatedly, and works for girls and boys. And here, there is no across-the-board screening or across-the-board diagnostic tools, so nobody is comparing apples with apples. They're just randomly thinking, well, in my experience and according to my interpretation of the DSM, you either fit or don't fit the criteria. And, of course, the DSM...
Mm.
is not particularly specific.
No. No, you spoke about ADOS. I do know Olga Tennison Autism Research Centre in Melbourne through La Trobe Uni. They've got a woman there by the name of Christelle Hoodry. She's a researcher, and she's pretty much the only person who is trained to teach diagnosticians and psychologists the ADOS tool. But they are pretty much using that at OTARC, and it's obviously something that's interested Sarah and I, because we've heard it's very comprehensive. Do you know much about it?
It's hugely comprehensive, and it's for children from 18 months approximately right through to late adolescence. And there's also a place in Sydney, Annie Centre, that trains people to use it as a diagnostic tool. So we were meant to go to do this training last year, and I did the ADIR several years ago, and we're going back to Sydney in March to do the ADOS training because I believe that it's a very comprehensive tool, and it picks up the nuances of where the challenges are and where the strengths are, as does the ADIR, and that's what I like. I don't think it's any good just going, we can tick these boxes on the DSM, yes, you've got this deficit, this deficit, this deficit. But those of us on the spectrum of adults know that deficit model doesn't describe us at all.
Mm. Well, let's hope that ADOS is sort of picked up by a lot of people around the country, because from what the word I'm hearing out of OTARC is that it's pretty good, and they're now trying to train just about anyone who would be interested. Mind you, it is very expensive, the training.
The training is very expensive, and also it's very expensive to administer the test. And as I understand from Autism South Australia, funding that the government provides to have a diagnostic test doesn't anywhere near cover the cost of running something like the ADOS or the ADIR, which is why they don't use them. Which seems to me crazy. You wouldn't say, well, we're not going to give you an MRI for your brain scan because that's too expensive. We're just going to randomly guess by using an X-ray that won't show us right.
You put it in a very good context. And don't you think that if the more people that use it, the cheaper it will become?
Yes, and also the more that you do it, the more useful. So the first ADIRs that I did took not only 2 or 3 hours for the interview, but 2 or 3 hours to do the coding. And I can now do the coding much quicker, and you can also just put your coding into the computer and it spits out the results at you now.
Mm. Well, because, yeah, I think, you know, when I read this article on, as I said, I think it's a couple of years old, about autism being overly diagnosed, I think ADOS would probably be able to work with that to sort of flesh that out a bit more and possibly not get that sort of diagnosis for autism if it's just a speech and language delay.
Yeah, that's right. And also to be very much more specific about criteria, because the DSM is quite woolly. What they've done with the ADOS and the ADIR is they've made the observational criteria very specific. And if you're not using a diagnostic tool, I'm not sure how you can justify your diagnosis for anything, not just for autism.
Mm. Okay, so now I have some questions from our listeners, Emma, and some of them I've put them into sort of categories. So hopefully you might be able to give these families some answers, because some of these stories are just very sad, actually. So the first one up is, are seclusion zones being used in a lot of schools harming to children with autism?
Can you say that again?
Seclusion zones are being used in a lot of schools, especially around here in Bendigo, I've heard as well. Are they harming children with autism?
It depends on how it's used, and it depends on what they mean by a seclusion zone. So one of the very successful things to do is to set up a quiet space, generally within or just outside the classroom, that the child is able to use as and when they need it. And when they are first learning to use these spaces, they don't know when they need them, and they may need prompting. Now's a good time to go to a quiet space or your calming space. However, if it's being used to punish children, then it's not a good idea. It needs to be used as a strategy for self-calming. So, for example, many of us on the spectrum, when we get overwhelmed, we need some time by ourselves to calm down. And if we give children the skills to know when that is happening, and as they're learning those skills, to show them how they can be in a safe space. Seclusion zone sounds kind of scary.
Yeah, no, I know a mum whose child was almost forced into a seclusion zone, and what I don't know if this is what this mother meant, but this other mother that I know, their child, it was sort of at the back of the classroom in the corner, and no one was allowed to enter into that seclusion zone, and the child was not allowed to leave the seclusion zone. And that happened also when they were outside playing sport. She drove past one day and saw all the kids playing sport, and her daughter was over in the corner a far way away, with nobody sitting with her, by the way, by herself on the iPad. And that was the seclusion zone, and I think that that's wrong.
No, that's not a seclusion zone at all. That's nothing to do with the child's free needs. That's about saying it's too hard to have a strategy to support you to manage sport. Many children on the spectrum will need time to stand on the sidelines and watch what's happening before they're comfortable joining in. However, to say you can't leave that space, whatever, I mean, you know, that's very, very stressful to put a child in a space like that and not give them the knowledge of how they're able to come back to join the classroom. And it's also saying you don't belong.
Mm.
And that's terrible because everybody needs a sense of belonging.
I also think that it's not sort of putting out there a good example for the other children in the class too.
That's right. It's saying this person is different and can be treated differently, and as adults we're treating them differently in a not particularly kind and compassionate way, and therefore you can too.
Mm, exactly. Now, the second question I have here, if you're finding the plans put in place for schools for children on the spectrum are not being followed through by the school, how should the parents approach the school?
First of all, I would approach the teacher and say, there are preventing you from putting it in place. And if the teacher stonewalls or is rude, then you would go up to the special needs coordinator and then the principal. And if you don't get any joy from them, you have to take it further to the education board, because they have all agreed this plan. In theory, they should be able to implement it. But sometimes teachers feel that they need to sign something that they actually don't know how to implement.
Mm.
It may be that they need staff training, and they may be willing to say that if you, what are the barriers? Is there anything that you need to implement this? It might be that they're being told, look, we're not giving you any money for the bits that you need, even if it's only $20, or we're not giving you the professional development that you need. And it's only when those things are taken up to a board level or a Department of Education level that it's going to be taken seriously, that teachers actually need professional development to implement these plans. They're not trained how to teach children with autism or how to teach in a manner that's different to the one that they're used to doing.
Mm. Okay, I have another one. I have a child aged 7 with autism at mainstream school who doesn't qualify for an aid, who when is extremely anxious will not concentrate and sit with the class. The teacher claims they have tried time out space and talking with my child about what's going on and nothing is working. I need help.
With query whether or not the child has other supports. You don't necessarily need a teacher aid, but you may need a visual support so that there's a visual timetable for the whole day, and then there's also one for each section of just a first then, so that the child knows what's going to be happening. Because one of the difficulties for kids on the spectrum is because we don't filter very well, the child may not know when the teacher is giving the class instructions and when they're giving them personally instructions, so they miss all that because they're listening to the cars on the street or the teacher next door. And so that anxiety builds up because they know they're annoying the teacher because they haven't done the work, didn't know they were meant to. So if you put in place some fairly simple visual skills, you can diminish a lot of the anxiety. As can the teacher just thinking, I can do this and I can teach this child and I believe in this child. Because if there isn't that kind of emotional feeling within the room and between the child and the teacher, it's not going to end well. The child is going to continue to be anxious.
And I think we sort of shortchange our kids a little bit too in that respect, because they can always sense feelings that are coming from other people as well. So if there's a negative feeling coming from that teacher, then they're going to sense it.
That's right, for sure. And it was really interesting as part of my research, I looked at research around teacher expectations for other groups of people. I found that the biggest barrier to achievement for Maori children with special needs was teacher expectation. And so that, of course, would be the same for non-Maori children with special needs or for any grouping of children. And the fact that we have presumed in the past that autistic children don't feel other people's feelings has been shown to be wrong by many, many adults on the spectrum, and we're starting to listen to children too and understand that they do feel that negative vibe. And if the teacher has low expectations or no expectations, the child is going to feel that, and if they don't like them, they're going to feel that too.
Mm-hmm. And it happens quite often, I think, which is really sad, but it does happen. I hate to say it, but it does happen. Now, I have another one. My son's school claims that there's no money for additional supports in the classroom for him, and there are 20 other children in the class that need their attention as well. I've met with the Department of Ed, the school, and they seem to be playing the blame game with one another. I'm thinking of lodging a complaint with the commission. Should I go ahead with this?
Well, go ahead with it. It's actually a systemic issue. I suspect it's exactly the same here as it is in money. The school doesn't have money. They ask the department, and the department says, we don't have any money. And it goes round and round and round, whereas what everybody should be doing is, okay, none of us have any money. What can we do as an institution that's free? And the problem is that if you look at the time, children on the spectrum need one-to-one instruction for the beginning of every test because they haven't necessarily picked it up because of that lack of filtering. If you add up 5 minutes for each new test in the day, it's quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Some schools get around this by seeing the child on the spectrum or anybody else with a receptive language or processing difficulty in a group of highly academic children who can give that one-to-one instruction. If the child can read, it's as simple as writing bullet points on a notepad, putting them by the child, and they can see exactly what they're meant to do. So there are strategies that cost, but this time money dichotomy is be there and accept that it costs slightly more to educate special needs children in the mainstream than people would like to think who are the decision makers.
Mm. It is. And another thing that we're finding too is you're getting a lot of false promises too. So once you do take it to the Department of Education, you know, you've taken that big step, and so the schools then come in and say, okay, well, we'll do this if you do this, and then you get the child back to school and for 2 months everything goes well, and then all of a sudden it's in the too hard basket again.
Yeah, that's right. And that's one of the things that makes me really angry is when it becomes in the too hard basket, because actually children on the spectrum are quite simple to educate as long as you gain their attention, their trust, and you like them.
Mm. Yes.
That's the basics, and those three are free.
I know. Why is it so simple, but yet we're finding it so hard to get the education sector to actually understand that? Everything, it's the answers are so simple, but they're not listening.
But I think it's because most teachers are not on the spectrum, and they genuinely don't understand spectrum children.
Mm.
And I could never understand why my colleagues didn't understand these kids until I got my diagnosis, and then I just realised that we're so different. All those misunderstandings all my life that I thought were cultural because I moved around the world a lot, nothing to do with being from a different culture. It was all the fact that I didn't get people who weren't on the spectrum.
I had we won't call it a heated discussion with someone who I actually don't really know on a Facebook thread of a friend of mine, and she was a teacher. She took a little bit of I get an issue with something that I'd written on a thread, and she pretty much came back at me with, you know, they don't get the appropriate education when they're at university on working with kids with autism, and that there are limitations to what they can do in the classroom with these kids. Do you believe these people, is that a cop-out, or do you think that they should actually be going on, if they don't know how to educate someone, go out and do a course on it?
I actually don't think it's a cop-out. I think that they're not trained, and that the cop-out is actually from the education system and the trainers who say, oh yes, we're going to send you out teachers that can teach absolutely anybody, but we haven't trained them to do that.
Mm.
The problem is that teachers don't get enough professional development leave, enough professional development money. For example, if you're a doctor, you get a certain large sum of money every year, thousands, to go and do professional development and paid leave. If you're a teacher, I'm not sure about in South Australia, but in New Zealand you get 2 days a term and $500 a year, which won't pay for anything. So one of the reasons that I wrote my book was that teachers don't have any money, and I felt that would give them at least a basis of understanding, hopefully, of not just the difference between the way that they are and the way that their spectrum kids are, but the small changes that they can make to their teaching that will really make a big difference to these children.
Mm. Because and another thing that I have found, I was speaking to a teacher friend of mine the other day who was saying that with university, they do an entire unit on Indigenous education, and obviously that's taking nothing away from Indigenous education, but she's now just finished third year, and so far they've done nothing on special needs education. And, you know, she said that when she goes and does all of her placement, not once has she had an Indigenous child in the classroom, but she's walked into nearly every classroom she's gone in to do her prac in, and there's been at least 3 to 4 special needs kids in that class.
And that's true. And when I did my training, we did a lot more child development psychology than I think many places do. However, we didn't do teaching special needs children. And I enrolled in an advanced diploma in special needs within 6 months of leaving my teacher training because I realised I didn't know how to do it. However, I'm obsessed with learning everything I can. And... doing the best I can, and that's a very Aspie trait. And so it didn't bother me that I was spending large amounts of my salary on professional development for myself that possibly should have been paid for by the education department. But if you are not on the spectrum, you may have different priorities. It may be more of a priority to have a family holiday or to spend quality time outside of work with family doing various social things. Whereas because I wasn't particularly social, it didn't bother me that I went home from work and sat and studied.
Well, I tell you what, the world is a better place with you in it. I mean it. Now, look, I've got another question here. I've got two more to go. My daughter is high functioning and in mainstream school. She did not attend for 4 months after her iPad was removed without warning, and the school kept telling me she didn't fit into any kind of box. We have started her back, but the school will only allow her back at 2 to 3 hours a day. Are they allowed to do this?
I don't know in Australia, but I would presume not, because every child has the right to education, and that's not part-time education, that's education. In New Zealand, that is illegal, and there's a lot, and there's a court case that's been going on against the Department of Education there for 10 years, I think. And one of the things that needs to be done very strongly in situations where schools are part-time excluding is the families need to sit down, work out, is this okay for their child? Is it not okay for their child? And if it's not, how their child would benefit from school the most. And then they need to take that and say, actually, you don't have the right to exclude my child, and this is what we need to make it work. Because what tends to happen in these situations is that if the family forced them to take them back, they find reasons to exclude them again.
Look, I actually know who this mum is, and I know the story behind this story. And, you know, the iPad was used... this was a child who hardly attended during term one and then all of a sudden wanted to go to school in term two because the school had worked out if they gave her an iPad for 6 hours a day and let her sit on it and play Minecraft or whatever it was, she was happy. And then one day they just decided to remove it. Okay, now it's time to actually do some education. She came home, didn't want to go to school, and for 4 months didn't go to school. This mum did absolutely everything to get this little girl back to school. They have now, obviously, after taking it to the Department of Education, they've now allowed 18 hours a week for an aide, but they are now stating that she's only able to attend when that aide is in attendance.
That was what they did in New Zealand, and that was what the court case was around. The school were there to educate, and they started the problem by giving her an iPad. What they should have done is they should have gone out and found people like myself who can support the school to work out how to provide a curriculum that is accessible for this girl. And one of the things with high-functioning autistics and people with Asperger's is that quite often schools are giving work that is too simple. And there is a misunderstanding about when a child on the work, kids always presume it's because they can't. It's quite often because they won't. And they won't when it's too easy as well as when it's too hard.
Mm-hmm.
The difficulty is that there's that sort of self-perpetuating cycle that goes around. The teacher gives them work which is too hard, and they don't do it, and they go, well, they can't do anything. or they give them work that's too easy and they say, oh, look, they're clearly really stupid because they can't do this. You know, why have you been telling us your child's really clever? They can't even do this work.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that they can't, it's because they won't. You haven't engaged the child. It's simple. We're all trained as teachers. You need to engage the child in order to engage learning.
I also find it quite funny when these kids who haven't been at school for extended periods of time receive their school reports for the term and they're glowing. They've done so well for the term, but that's because they haven't been there. And you know, this is where we're at here too. And look, we touched on the hidden curriculum, and one of the questions that came through was obviously someone who was listening is how can we prepare our kids for the hidden curriculum? I have a child starting school next year. What should parents be looking out for to prepare their child for this hidden curriculum?
One of the most important things that you can do to prepare your child to start school is that they need to know to greet people. So it's really important to greet the teacher, answer their name at roll. And it's also important that if they meet people in the playground to say hello and to smile. And it's really interesting because children on the spectrum don't know to smile and they don't know that other people like it. And it's as simple as saying, when you meet new people, smile, other people like it when you smile.
Mm-hmm.
And for some unknown reason, if you greet the teacher when you first go into the classroom, they presume you're a lovely child. It's that politeness and that etiquette thing. And for the rest of the hidden curriculum, it's about teaching things really specifically so that children understand the difference between nice people and not nice people.
Mm-hmm.
Someone takes your lunch, they're not nice. Friends don't do this. And when people do that, that you need to tell the teacher and you need to tell dad, because our kids are more at risk of bullying.
Have noticed too that when getting back to the whole eye contact thing, that is a big thing when children don't make eye contact and people think that they're being rude. And this is obviously for older children as they're getting older, because younger kids sort of, they don't take much notice of that sort of thing, but older children do. And so is there anything that we could be teaching our kids for that sort of thing if that arises?
Yeah, I teach to look at the forehead. Some people teach to look at the nose.
Yeah.
And it's generally look at the person, looking towards the face area if possible. And again, people like it when you do this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite interesting because eye contact is very cultural. In some countries it's rude to make eye contact, and in others it's obligatory, and in others it's sort of brief and then look away, and in others it's more sustained. So you need to teach what's culturally appropriate for not just where you live, but the community that you live within. I often wonder how they diagnose autism in countries where eye contact is inappropriate.
Because I'm seeing this huge surge, because for a while there, China, I think it was autism was only recognised over there like a couple of years ago, but I'm seeing a huge surge of things coming out of China at the moment. They're really getting with the program. I watched this documentary and I was absolutely appalled actually after watching it, but now I'm just seeing like they're really getting on board with a lot of the education and they're like sending people and they're not focusing on the eye contact as much as the social skills.
Yeah, and it's about the fact that culturally what's more important in China is to be part of that collective community. It's not to make eye contact. Whereas because we're a more individualistic society here, it's more important that we make eye contact than we're part of a community. Whereas I think naturally it's easiest to play on our sense of social justice and our sense of wanting to belong. So teaching us ways to belong and to express that social justice appropriately. Many of our wee ones will be described by their first teachers as class policemen.
Now, I have one more before I have to go off for news and weather at 11. So it's not a long one because this is actually mine, because I am transitioning my daughter, as a lot of people are, into school. What are the sorts of things should I and other families be looking at when we're writing up those transition plans for our children when they're starting prep?
So you need to be looking at the ability to visit school first when nobody is in the school, and to be having possibly more visits than other children. You need to be able to enable your transitioning kids to get a feel for the layout of the school, get a feel for the atmosphere of the school without people in it, and then get a feel for a classroom, not necessarily with people in it. And then to be able to meet the teacher by themselves, and then to be able to meet the class. And it's possible that for some of our kids, going an hour a day for a few days and then 2 hours a day and building it up is the right way to go. But for others, it's better to just put them right in there straight away. And a lot of it depends on their attitude. Are they looking forward to going to school? And also explain to the kids when they transition that school is where you learn new things. And this is a bit of a problem if you've got a child that can already read and write,
mm-hmm.
and the school don't go with that, because quite often they are still insisting, okay, you have to do what everybody else does. So it's really important that when you're getting that transition plan, that the schools know exactly where your children are at. Can they read? Can they write? If not, what are the barriers for them doing so? Is it that shiny paper is a barrier? In a school a few weeks ago, a beginning student, and he was sitting right underneath the fluorescent light, simming constantly. Well, you need to move him from under that light because it's awful.
Mm.
And teacher hadn't even thought of that, because why would you? If that's not in your understanding, you don't think about those things. And that's where parents are great advocates. If you know your child's sensory issues, you need to put those into your transition plan so that they're catered for.
Mm. Well, I'm happy to tell you, Emma, that most of what you just said is what I've actually been doing. We had two visits at the beginning that were just awful. They just plonked us straight into the classroom full of kids, and 20 metres from out the front of the door, when she saw how many kids were in that classroom, she was just like, I want to go home. So we tried it twice and failed, and so I said to the school, right, we've tried it your way, now we're going to try it my way. And we did what you said, which was the empty classroom and then the one-on-one meeting with the teacher. We haven't sort of moved forth with that because obviously we've had a bit of illness in the house this week, and so we're going to continue that for the next couple of weeks and then slowly bring children into the classroom as opposed to her going into a full classroom. Do you think that's a good idea?
Yeah, that's a fantastic idea. And also to take photographs while you're doing the visits and put together your own picture storybook, which can be a formal social story or just an informal, look, this is where you're going to be at school, this is your teacher, this is who you're going to make friends with. And if your child has a special interest, one of those visits, to be able to take some object from that special interest and share it with the class.
Mm, that sounds wonderful. Well, I have to say adieu to you, my dear, but I am so happy that you've come on today to answer our listeners' questions and also just share your wisdom and knowledge. And I'm just going to let our listeners know that over the next 2 weeks I'm actually going to be giving away copies of your book. So they need to check into our Facebook page to find out how we are going to do that, and I'll be letting people know how they can win a copy of your book, which I think is just fascinating. It's fantastic. And I tell you what, Tony Langdon is a number one fan of yours, so any number one fan of yours is a number one fan of mine.
Thank you. And I suppose if you come across a school that you're transitioning your child to where they really look like they haven't got a clue, even though they're going yes, yes, or saying the right thing, getting them a copy of the book would really help. And if you don't want to get a hard copy for them, you can buy a Kindle version, which I think is only $10.
Oh, fantastic. Look, Emma, thanks again for coming on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on here, and hopefully we'll have you back on. I mean, you're going to be a resident soon, so thank you again. I really appreciate it. Enjoy your time in Australia before you have to head back to New Zealand.
Thank you very much. I'm heading back next week, and then I'll be back on Christmas Eve for good.
Oh, wonderful. We'll speak to you then. Thank you again.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
She's just wonderful. Thank you again to Dr. Emma Goodall.
The voice of your community, 106.7 Phoenix FM.
Tonight, yeah, baby, tonight, yeah, baby. Right on the limits. 106.7 Phoenix FM.
I am playing my one of my most famous TEDx presentations of Dr. Temple Grandin, and she talks about, it's called The World Has All Different Types of Brains, and this is absolutely fantastic. You're going to love this, and if you don't, deal with it. Now, as I said, the world needs all different kinds of minds. Look, this presentation only goes for about 12 minutes, but the Q&A session that happens afterwards is actually quite fantastic. So enjoy this, and when I come back, we'll talk to Brendan about why he's come up for this theme for his show today. Okay, enjoy it, and I'll be speaking to you soon.
I think I'll start out and just talk a little bit about what exactly autism is. Autism is a very big continuum that goes from very severe, the child remains nonverbal, all the way up to brilliant scientists and engineers. And I actually feel at home here because there's a lot of autism genetics here. You wouldn't have any... It's a continuum of traits. When does a nerd turn into, Asperger, which is just mild autism? I mean, Einstein and Mozart and Tesla would all be probably diagnosed as autistic spectrum today. And one of the things that really is going to concern me is getting these kids to be the ones that are going to invent the next energy things, that Bill Gates talked about this morning. Okay, now if you want to understand autism animals, and I want to talk to you about different ways of thinking, you have to get away from verbal language. I think in pictures. I don't think in language. Now, the thing about the autistic mind is it attends to details. Okay, this is a test where you either have to pick out the big letters or pick out the little letters, and the autistic mind picks out the little letters more quickly. And the thing is, the normal brain ignores the details. Well, if you're building a bridge, details are pretty important because it'll fall down if you ignore the details. And one of my big concerns with a lot of policy things today is things are getting too abstract. People are getting away from doing hands-on stuff. I'm really concerned that a lot of the schools have taken out the hands-on classes because art and classes like that, those were the classes where I excelled. Okay, in my work with cattle, I noticed a lot of little things that most people don't notice would make the cattle balk. Like, for example, this flag waving right in front of the veterinary facility. This feed yard was going to tear down their whole veterinary facility. All they needed to do was move the flag. Rapid movement, contrast. In the early 70s, when I started, I got right down in the chutes to see what cattle were seeing. People thought that was crazy. A coat on a fence would make them balk. Shadows would make them balk. A hose on the floor. People weren't noticing these things. A chain hanging down. And that's shown very, very nicely in the movie. In fact, I loved the movie how they duplicated all my projects. That's the geek side. My drawings got the star in the movie, too. And actually, it's called Temple Grandin, not Thinking in Pictures. So what is Thinking in Pictures? It's literally movies in your head. My mind works like Google for images. Now, when I was a young kid, I didn't know my thinking was different. I thought everybody thought in pictures. And then when I did my book, Thinking in Pictures, I started interviewing people about how they think. And I was shocked to find out that my thinking was quite different. Like if I say, think about a church steeple, most people get this sort of generalized, generic one. Now, maybe that's not true in this room, but it's going to be true in a lot of different places. I see only specific pictures. They flash up into my memory just like Google for pictures. And in the movie, they've got a great scene in there where the word shoe is said and a whole bunch of 50s and 60s shoes pop into my imagination. Okay, there's my childhood church. That's specific. There's some more. Fort Collins. Okay, how about famous ones? And they just kind of come up kind of like this, just really quickly, like Google for pictures. And they come up one at a time. And then I can think, well, okay, well, maybe we can have it snow or we can have a thunderstorm. I can hold it there and turn them into videos. Now, visual thinking was a tremendous asset in my work designing cattle handling facilities. And I've worked really hard on improving how cattle are treated at the slaughter plant. I'm not going to go into any gucky slaughter slides. I've got that stuff up on YouTube if you want to look at it. But one of the things that I was able to do in my design work is I could actually test run a piece of equipment in my mind, just like a virtual reality computer system. And this is an aerial view of a recreation of one of my projects that was used in the movie. That was like just so super cool. And there were a lot of kind of Asperger types and autism types working out there on the movie set, too. But one of the things that really worries me is where's the younger version of those kids going today? They're not ending up in Silicon Valley where they belong. Now, one of the things I learned very early on, because I wasn't that social, is I had to sell my work and not myself. And the way I sold livestock jobs is I showed off my drawings, I showed off pictures of things. Another thing that helped me as a little kid is, boy, in the 50s you were taught manners. You were taught you can't pull the merchandise off the shelves in a store and throw it around. Now, when kids get to be in third or fourth grade, you might see that this kid's going to be a visual thinker, drawing in perspective. Now, I want to emphasize that not every autistic kid's going to be a visual thinker. Now, I did had this brain scan done several years ago, and I used to joke around about having a gigantic internet trunk line going deep into my visual cortex. This is tensor imaging, and my great big internet trunk line is twice as big as the controls. The red lines there are me, and the blue lines are the sex and age matched control. And there I got a gigantic one, and the control over there, the blue one, has got a really small one. And some of the research now is showing that people on the spectrum actually think with primary visual cortex. Now the thing is, the visual thinker is just one kind of mind. You see, the autistic mind tends to be a specialist mind, good at one thing, bad at something else. And where I was bad was algebra. And I was never allowed to take geometry or trig. Gigantic mistake. I'm finding a lot of kids that need to skip algebra, go right to geometry and trig. Now, another kind of mind is the pattern thinker. More abstract. These are your engineers, your computer programmers. Now, this is pattern thinking. That praying mantis is made from a single sheet of paper. No scotch tape, no cuts. And there in the background is the pattern for folding it. Here are the types of thinking. Photorealistic visual thinkers like me. Pattern thinkers, music and math minds. Some of these oftentimes have problems with reading. You also will see these kind of problems with kids that are dyslexic. You'll see these different kinds of minds. And then there's a verbal mind. They know every fact about everything. Now, another thing is the sensory issues. I was really concerned about having to wear this gadget on my face. And I came in half an hour beforehand so I could have it put on and kind of get used to it. And they got it bent so it's not hitting my chin. But sensory is an issue. Some kids are bothered by fluorescent lights. Others have problems with sound sensitivity. You know, it's going to be variable. Now, visual thinking gave me a whole lot of insight into the animal mind. Because think about it. An animal's a sensory-based thinker, not verbal. Thinks in pictures. Thinks in sounds. Thinks in smells. Think about how much information there is there on the local fire hydrant. He knows who's been there. When they were there, are they friend or foe? Is there anybody he can go mate with? There's a ton of information on that fire hydrant. It's all very detailed information. And looking at these kind of details gave me a lot of insight into animals. Now, the animal mind, and also my mind, puts sensory-based information into categories. Man on a horse and a man on the ground, that is viewed as two totally different things. You can have a horse that's been abused by a rider. They'll be absolutely fine with the veterinarian and with the horseshoer, but you can't ride them. You have another horse where maybe the horseshoer beat him up, and he'll be terrible for anything on the ground with the veterinarian, but a person can ride him. Cattle are the same way. Man on a horse, a man on foot, they're two different things. You see, it's a different picture. So I want you to think about just how specific this is. Now, this ability to put information into categories, I find a lot of people are not very good at this. Like when I'm out troubleshooting with equipment or problems with something in a plant, they don't seem to be able to figure out, do I have a training people issue or do I have something wrong with the equipment? In other words, categorize equipment problem from a people problem. I find a lot of people have difficulty doing that. Now, let's say I figure out, is it an equipment problem? Is it a minor problem with something simple I can fix? Or is the whole design of the system wrong? People have a hard time figuring that out. Let's just look at something like, you know, solving problems with, you know, making airlines safer. Yeah, I'm a million-mile flyer. I do lots and lots of flying. And you know, like if I was at the FFA, what would I be doing a lot of direct observation of? It would be their airplane tails. You know, 5 fatal wrecks in the last 20 years. Tail either came off or steering stuff inside the tail broke in some way. It's tails, pure and simple. And when the pilots walk around the plane, guess what? They can't see that stuff inside the tail. You know, now as I think about that, I'm pulling up all of that, you know, specific information. It's specific. See, my thinking's bottom up. I take all the little pieces and I put the pieces together like a puzzle. Now here's a horse that was deathly afraid of black cowboy hats. He'd been abused by somebody with a black cowboy hat. White cowboy hats, that was absolutely fine. Now the thing is, the world is going to need all of the different kinds of minds to work together. We've got to work on developing all these different kinds of minds. And one of the things that's driving me really crazy as I travel around and I do autism meetings is I'm seeing a lot of smart, geeky, nerdy kids. And they just aren't very social. And nobody's working on developing their interest in something like science. And this brings up the whole thing of my science teacher. My science teacher is shown absolutely beautifully in the movie. I was a goofball student when I was in high school. I just didn't care at all about studying until I had a Mr. Carlock's science class. He was now Dr. Carlock in the movie. And he got me challenged to figure out an optical illusion room. This brings up the whole thing of you got to show kids interesting stuff. You know, one of the things that I think maybe TED ought to do is tell all the schools about all the great lectures that are on TED. And there's all kinds of great stuff on the internet to get these kids turned on. Because I'm seeing a lot of these geeky, nerdy kids, and the teachers out in the Midwest and other parts of the country, when you get away from these tech areas, they don't know what to do with these kids. And they're not going down the right path. The thing is, you can make a mind to be more of a thinking and cognitive mind, or a mind can be wired to be more social. And what some of the research now has shown in autism is there may be extra wiring back here in a really brilliant mind, and we lose a few social circuits here. It's kind of a trade-off between thinking and social. And then you can get into the point where it's so severe, you're going to have a person that's going to be nonverbal. In the normal human mind, language covers up the visual thinking we share with animals. This is the work of Dr. Bruce Miller, and he studied Alzheimer's patients that had frontal temporal lobe dementia. And the dementia ate out the language parts of the brain, and then this artwork came out of somebody that used to install stereos in cars. Now, Van Gogh doesn't know anything about physics. But I think it's very interesting that there was some work done to show that this eddy pattern in this painting followed a statistical model of turbulence. This brings up the whole interesting idea of maybe some of this mathematical patterns is in our own head. And the Wolfram stuff, I was taking notes and I was writing down all the search words I could use because I think that's going to go on in my autism lectures. We've got to show these kids interesting stuff. And they've taken out the auto shop class and the drafting class and the art class. I mean, art was my best subject in school. We've got to think about all these different kinds of minds, and we've got to absolutely work with these kind of minds, because we absolutely are going to need these kind of people in the future. And let's talk about jobs. Okay, my science teacher got me studying because I was a goofball that didn't want to study. But you know what? I was getting work experience. I'm seeing too many of these smart kids that haven't learned basic things like how to be on time. I was taught that when I was 8 years old. You know, how to have table manners at granny's Sunday party. I was taught that when I was very, very young. And when I was 13, I had a job at a dressmaker's shop sewing clothes. I did internships in college. I was building things. And I also had to learn how to do assignments. You know, all I wanted to do is draw pictures of horses when I was little. The mother said, well, let's do a picture of something else. They've got to learn how to do something else. Let's say the kid's fixated on Legos. Let's get them working on building different things. The thing about the autistic mind is it tends to be fixated. Like if the kid loves race cars, let's use race cars for math. Let's figure out how long it takes a race car to go a certain distance. In other words, use that fixation in order to motivate that kid. That's one of the things we need to do. I really get fed up when the teachers, especially when you get away from this part of the country, they don't know what to do with these smart kids. It just drives me crazy. What can visual thinkers do when they grow up? They can do graphic design, all kinds of stuff with computers, photography, industrial design. The pattern thinkers, they're the ones that are going to be your mathematicians, your software engineers, your computer programmers, all of those kinds of jobs. And then you've got the word minds. They make great journalists. And they also make really, really good stage actors. Because the thing about being autistic is I had to learn social skills like being in a play. You just kind of just have to learn it. And we need to be working with these students. And this brings up mentors. You know, my science teacher was not an accredited teacher. He was a NASA space scientist. Now, some states now are getting it to where if you have a degree in biology or a degree in chemistry, you can come into the school and teach, you know, biology or chemistry. We need to be doing that. Because what I'm observing is the good teachers for a lot of these kids are out in the community colleges. But we need to be getting some of these good teachers into the high schools. Another thing that can be very, very, very successful is there's a lot of people that may have retired from, you know, working in the software industry. And they can teach a kid. And it doesn't matter if what they teach them is old. Because what you're doing is you're lighting the spark. You're getting that kid turned on. And you get them turned on, then you'll learn all the new stuff. Mentors are just essential. I cannot emphasize enough what my science teacher did for me. And we've got to mentor them, hire them. And if you bring them in for internships in your companies, the thing about the autism Asperger-y kind of mind, you got to give them a specific task. Don't just say design new software. You got to tell them something a lot more specific. Well, we're designing a software for a phone, and it has to do some specific thing, and it can only use so much memory. That's the kind of specificity you need. Well, that's the end of my talk, and I just want to thank everybody for coming. It was great to be here. Oh, you have a question for me? Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that. You know, you once wrote, I like this quote, if by some magic autism had been eradicated from the face of the earth, then men would still be socializing in front of a wood fire at the entrance to a cave.
What? Because who do you think made the first stone spear? It was the Asperger guy, and if you were to get rid of all the autism genetics, there'd be no more Silicon Valley, and the energy crisis would not be solved.
So I want to ask you a couple other questions, and you know, if any of these feel inappropriate, it's okay just to say next question. But if there's someone here who has an autistic child or knows an autistic child and feels kind of cut off from them, what advice would you give them?
Well, first of all, we got to look at age. If you have a 2-, 3-, or 4-year-old, you know, no speech, no social interaction, I can't emphasize enough, don't wait. You need at least 20 hours a week of one-to-one teaching. You know, the thing is, autism comes in different degrees. There's going to be about half the people on the spectrum that are not going to learn to talk and they're not going to be working in Silicon Valley. That would not be a reasonable thing for them to do. But then you get these smart, geeky kids, you know, the touch of autism, and that's where you've got to get them turned on with doing interesting things. I got social interaction through shared interests. I rode horses with other kids. I made model rockets with other kids. Did electronics lab, you know, with other kids. And in the 60s, it was gluing mirrors onto a rubber membrane on speaker to make a light show. That was like, we consider that super cool.
Is it unrealistic for them to hope or think that that child loves them, as some might most
wish?
Well,
let me tell you, that child will be loyal, and if your house is burning down, they're going to get you out of it.
Wow. So most people, if you ask them what are they most passionate about, they'd say things like, my kids or my lover or... What are you most passionate about?
I'm passionate about that the things I do are going to make the world a better place. When I have a mother of an autistic child say, my kid went to college because of your book or something, or one of your lectures, that makes me happy. You know, the slaughter plants I've worked with them in the 80s, they were absolutely awful. I developed a really simple scoring system for slaughter plants where you just measure outcomes. How many cattle fell down, how many cattle got poked with the prodder, how many cattle are mooing their heads off. And it's very, very simple. You directly observe a few simple things. It's worked really well. I get satisfaction out of seeing stuff that makes real change in the real world. We need a lot more of that and a lot less abstract stuff. Oh, no.
When we were talking on the phone, one of the things you said that really astonished me was you said one thing you were passionate about was server farms. Tell me
about
that.
Well, the reason why I got really excited and I read about that, it contains knowledge. It's libraries. And to me, knowledge is something that is extremely valuable. So maybe over 10 years ago now, our library got flooded. And this is before the internet got really big. And I was really upset about all the books being wrecked because it was knowledge being destroyed. And server farms or data centers are great libraries of knowledge.
Temple, can I just say it's an absolute delight to have you at TED.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you.
And that was Dr. Temple Grandin with her presentation from TEDx from actually a couple of years ago on The World Needs All Different Types of Minds, where she spoke about teaching and education. Obviously, a lot of Temple's presentations are based around high-functioning autistics from the Silicon Valley, because obviously that's who, that's a part of her psyche. But, you know, love the woman. Gotta love her. She's awesome.
You got to Father's time, but I'm dancing on the Valentine. I tell you, somebody's fooling around with my chances on the danger line. I'll cross that bridge when I find it. Another day to make my
106.7 Phoenix FM.
Now, in the studio, I have a gentleman here who is a volunteer with the Office of the Public Advocate, and he has a very interesting thing that he does, and obviously he's here today to tell you all about what he does and what is available to families whose children or teenagers or adults might get into a little bit of trouble with the law. Welcome to the show, Stephen, and thanks so much for coming.
Morning, Beck.
Thank you so much. So now, the Office of the Public Advocate, what is it that they actually provide to individuals on the autism spectrum?
Well, their function, as stated, is to protect, promote the interests and rights and dignity of people with a disability. That's their general function. They exist within the Department of Justice, state government level. And in this particular case, they supply what are called independent third persons or independent persons to attend police interviews for people with a cognitive disability or mental illness. Cognitive disability is defined as it can be acquired brain injury, autism, Asperger's, dementia, and or mental illness, of course. Mm-hmm. And if the police become aware that the person has any of those conditions, they automatically have to, by law, have an independent person present. Mm-hmm. They have a number they call a call centre that they call, mm-hmm. and the call centre determines that an ITP, or independent third person, is necessary, and they'll call one, and I'm one of those people that they call. Okay. And the first thing we do is we have a we talk with the person who's being interviewed, and it could also be victims and people who are giving witness statements as well. Mm-hmm. Right, it can be all three. We get to talk to the person quite independent of the police. We explain to the person that we are independent of the police and we're basically there for that person, to support that person, because police interviews can be quite scary for anybody, you know, let alone someone with autism. Yeah, and it can be. And
the first thing,
that's right. The first thing we have to determine is that the person is able to adequately understand their rights. Mm-hmm. You know, their right to silence. You're not obliged to say or do anything, but anything you say to can be given evidence. The police approach is very formalised, you know, and tends to be very repetitive too. They keep going over these rights over and over and over. They have a card they have to read off of, and, you know, it can be quite confusing for anybody. And I'm there to help the person understand their rights and to exercise those rights. They have a right to communicate with or attempt to communicate with a friend or relative to let them know that the police station, for a start. Mm-hmm. They have the same right in terms of a lawyer. And if they're Aboriginal, they have a right to get in contact or inform an organisation called VELS, the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service. Mm-hmm. They're there. That's a special requirement. To make sure that they understand their rights. We do that by getting the person to explain their rights in their own terms. It's not good enough to just nod and say, yeah, I understand.
Yeah.
And if that's what's occurring, I'll intervene in the interview and say, look, that's not good enough, right? Especially that the person understands that they have a right to silence. They can say nothing at all, you know. Mm-hmm. And they can say no comment if they want to everything, you know, apart from giving their name and date of birth, of course, which they are required to do. But
So, obviously, this came, like, when you contacted me during the week, I never knew that this existed. And so I'm obviously, maybe because I only have small children who have autism, but it's something that I think all parents who have children on the spectrum should know, that this is their right, and they should be teaching this to their children, that if they do find themselves either in trouble with the law, or they have witnessed something occur, or whether they are a victim, this is the first thing that they should ask for. What do they ask for?
Well, they can. I mean, we're not trying to replace the role of a parent or anything like that, mm-hmm. right? Sometimes the situation will arise where the person is in dispute with a parent or guardian, and so the parent or guardian can't be present at the interview because of conflict of interest, and so it'll automatically come back to us, right? But we do have the ability to assess whether the person is even competent to proceed with the interview. I've had a couple of occasions where that's occurred and I've discussed it with the police and they've agreed with me. We have a good relationship with the police, you know. If I think that they can't proceed with the interview, the police have the right to call in what's called the FMO, Forensic Medical Officer, who's a medically trained person who will come in and do an assessment, right? It's never happened in my personal experience, right? Mm-hmm. But there is that provision, you know. How the police would respond to a parent saying, no, I don't think you can interview my child, I'm not so sure about, right? They might not take too much notice of that, right? But they do have to take notice of an ITP in terms of that regard, right? But, yeah, I mean, for the older people, it's important that they tell the police that they have autism, Asperger's, acquired brain injury or whatever, mm-hmm. right? I've had situations where I've been in the police station and the person said, oh, well, I've been interviewed by the police 6 times in the past and I've never had an ITP yet. And I said, oh, okay, you know, what's going on? Have you mentioned that you had autism or whatever? Sometimes it's because they haven't, right?
Yeah.
If they have in the past, it's generally on the police computer called LEAP, Legal Evidence Program. It'll be flagged.
Yeah.
And so if the flag comes up, they'll automatically get on the call centre and get an ITP in.
Oh,
you
know? So that's an automatic thing that
If it is flagged, I mean, I've had situations where it hasn't been flagged, and in consultation with the person, we've asked that the police flag it
yeah.
for future purposes, right? Yeah. And the police will do that, right? But we can involve, like, there's more practical things, like I've had situations where the person was from Melbourne, for instance. The police wanted to charge the person and bail them to appear at Bendigo Court. And I said, well, hang on a minute. This person's not going to have any chance of getting from Melbourne back to Bendigo Court, right?
Mm.
In discussion with the police, they agreed that they'd change that and bail a person to a court near their house in Melbourne.
Okay. Right?
And I've had actually the reverse. Someone living in Bendigo, Shepparton police come over, wanted to bail a person to appear in Shepparton. The person's got no transport or anything. I said, you're setting them up to fail. They can't possibly get to Shepparton.
Yeah.
There wasn't any requirement for other witnesses or anything, so the police agreed, okay, we won't do that. We'll bail it to Bendigo.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you can help out in those areas like that, you know.
So this is a volunteer role.
How
did you get involved with this?
Oh, I've worked in the welfare field in the past. I'm retired now, but I've been in the welfare field in the past. So I did know about it. I do it with another organisation called YRIP, which is Youth Referral and Independent Person Program. That's for people under 18,
mm-hmm.
same sort of role, but specifically for people under 18. And same call centre is used and same procedures, basically, right?
Yeah.
And, it was just a natural fit for me. To fit into it, and I'm retired. I've got plenty of time.
Yeah.
I've got the interest to do it. I live right near the police station. Yeah, we tried to get there within 30. The arrangement is we tried to get there within 30 minutes.
Okay.
Bendigo's a small place, and I could be anywhere in Bendigo, and I get to the police station in 15 minutes.
Yeah,
you know, if I'm on call, so we can usually fit that requirement pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want people to be sitting in cells for too long or anything else.
Oh.
One of the things you want to do is try to get through the process, get the person through the process as smoothly as possible, as stress-free as possible,
yeah.
you know. But just, ensure their rights, sure they understand their rights, and that everything is done correctly, you know. This fingerprinting is an interesting one. The police have the right to fingerprint you, except if you're 14 or younger,
mm-hmm.
right, and then they've got to get the permission of the person, the young person, plus the parent. If they can't get that, they're going to get a court order. Generally, the police won't bother. I'll point out, hey, look, you can't do it. This person's only 14 or 13 or 10 or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And but I've had situations where the young person said, oh, they fingerprinted me last time.
Oh.
In that situation, I actually have to notify either YRIP or OPA that's happened,
mm-hmm.
and it comes back and the prints get destroyed, you know.
So now, if people want to become volunteers, do they have to have a background in welfare?
Not necessarily. You're trained. In the case of the Office of Public Advocate, they actually have their own training,
mm-hmm.
and they have update once a year. You do update training, and they keep you up to date on things as things change.
Okay.
We've just had a change in the area of when an interview requires a DVD to be done, audio-visual DVD.
Yep.
A couple of years ago, the police decided that they'd only give the person the audio copy because they're putting them on Facebook and things like that, right, which is illegal. They're supposed to do what they're doing.
Mm.
So they restricted it to audio only. Then they found out recently that they had no right to do that. So now they reverted back to getting an audio-visual copy, which you get the tape, the person gets the tape with them. Their lawyer might want to look at it and see what the interview was said in the interview and so forth, you know. But there's little changes like that and things happening all the time. So we have to be kept up to date on what's going on, you know.
Okay. Well, so now if people want to find out more information, how can they go about that? There's a website.
There's a website, publicadvocate.vic.gov.au, which is a general public advocate website. And they do run other programs. They run a guardianship program. They run a community visitor program, which is
mm-hmm.
people visiting institutions where people have a disability. and writing reports on, just keeping an overview, basically,
yeah,
on what happens in those sorts of institutions.
And this is just a Victorian service, isn't
just
it?
Victorian,
it's not,
yeah,
actually available in any other state.
Different states do their own thing. Yeah, different states do different things.
Yeah.
And this is strictly state government, Victoria.
Okay, so this is for all our Victorian listeners. Mm. So I will make sure that I put this information up on our Facebook page, the website, with the link through to it, so that if parents want to read more about it. But
okay,
I think it's something that's really important, mm, that parents should know and that their kids should know about, so that if they are in that situation, that's the first thing that they
ask. And
they
will
for.
Be, if as long as they mention the fact that they've, you know, they've got autism or whatever it is, it should automatically trigger the police to get in touch and get an ITP in, right? And the parents can be sure that the child will be supported, or the person will be supported in that situation. You know, that's the most important thing.
Oh, fantastic. Look, thank you so much for taking the time out to come in. Because, as I said, when you contacted me, I knew that this was something that we needed to get out on the radio for listeners to hear, because it is so very important that parents know this information. Nobody wants their child to get into trouble. Nobody wants their child to be a victim of crime, and nobody wants their child to be a witness to a crime, especially a child with autism. But I think it's very imperative that they have this information, so that if they ever do need to use it, they know. So I hope everybody out there actually got a bit out of this. And again, thank you so much for coming into the studio, Stephen. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
The voice of your community, 106.7 Phoenix FM.
Let's drop! So warm.
Well, that's all for this week. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll be back next week with more Real People Talk Autism. Until then, take care and goodbye.